So, as I mentioned before, we were sitting together. I've been thinking of all of you and aware of both the opportunity and the challenge of practicing on one's own, right? Cultivating and nurturing a practice in our home. And I have noticed over the years, and I've heard from many other people that frequently, not always, but frequently, it's more challenging than being in a community, being with Sangha, which is one of the reasons why Sangha is one of the three jewels, right, in which we can reliably go for support, for care. And having spiritual friends as we do now, it makes an enormous difference. It helps the mind cultivate an association to our practice and to working with our awareness, working with our capacity for insight. And so we're so fortunate that Alan and Susanna have helped us sustain Sangha, right? Sustain relationship to community. Nevertheless, we're doing so from our own homes. And you might be finding that given how extreme our circumstances are, given how provocative they are, right? All of this uncertainty, all of the new experiences that we're having, right? Some of us have had experiences that are similar, but not exactly the same. We really need our practice more than ever, right? We need some way to help the mind recover from being in a turbulent state. Probably not all of you experience the turbulence, but I definitely notice I do, right? I see the statistics at times, or I hear of someone, whether or not I know them, who's suffering, and it can be very, very stirring. So I thought I'd talk with you today just about nurturing your home practice, because sometimes it can be a little confusing. There's so many ways to practice. Even if you've been practicing within one tradition, there are lots of methods. And so I thought I might just talk through some of the key components of a daily practice. And by daily practice, I mean it could be 5 minutes, because 5 minutes really does go a long way. Or it could be an hour, right? It's really whatever is possible for you. Whether you're in a Theravadin tradition, CMC comes out of the Theravadin tradition, or you're in a Mahayana tradition practicing Tibetan Buddhism or Zen, Pure Land, in all of these traditions, we find methods to help the mind begin to settle, right? To cultivate some concentration. And that practice alone, even though it makes a lot of sense, can be provocative, because often there are parts of the psyche that start to feel concerned about not being able to settle. Right, especially if it feels like we should be paying attention to something in the secular world, or because our minds are typically very active. But however we're practicing, whatever the tradition, we're going to be using methods to just gather, to harness our awareness, right? And to do it, I like to emphasize with some gentleness and with some patience. Right, especially if there's a lot that's tugging on our awareness. And then, as we were talking about last week, we bring that concentration to something in particular, We bring it to an insight, right? Or we bring it to an object of focus. And this was the historical Buddha Shakyamuni's great contribution. He said, well, it is extremely important to be able to settle the mind, right? To allow it to be somewhere and to know where it is. This is how we learn, right? And sociologists, anthropologists all seem to suggest that our defining feature as human beings is our capacity to learn, right? It's what we begin with in our first breath, and it is with us, right? Some would even say after our last breath, depending on your spiritual beliefs. But that capacity to learn is what makes us human. And so if we can gather the mind, then we really are setting the conditions to be able to work with something that is healing, right? It's something that opens our understanding, right? Reinforces awareness, insight. Yeah. So if we think about that combination of concentration and insight, It's helpful to keep that in mind when you're trying to nurture your own practice. But then, of course, there are other things that are needed, right? And the first thing, and again, I'm aware some of you have already done this, but for those of you who have been thinking this through in new ways since we're not going out as much, it's really helpful to have a place that we associate with practice, right? I mean, this is why in all religious traditions we have symbols, so that the mind can begin to associate the symbol with what we're exploring, what we're learning. Yeah. So in the Buddhist tradition, we have all sorts of imagery, right? We have Buddha statues and we have tankas. And we have mala beads, right? And lots of other symbols that help us become aware that we have these extraordinary capacities to use the mind as an agent of healing, right? To chew on something, to grapple with something that helps us take in increased insight and then navigate life with more ease. More skill, less suffering. So in our New York City spaces, and there's, I'm sure, quite a spectrum in this community in terms of how much space we have, I encourage you to find some space that your mind associates with practice. And it can be the tiniest space, and it might be a multi-purpose space. That's okay, too. But some space where, even if your mind is riled, right, even if you find that you're really gripped by what's happening, right, and you might be experiencing something very acute personally, so the mind is easily riled these days. If you have a place where you don't have to work too hard. Your mind doesn't have to work too hard to settle because it almost automatically associates it with some increased spaciousness, some awareness. This is extremely helpful. So if you have a place where you can have some imagery, it could be pictures of teachers who have offered you inspiration, or Buddha statues, or flowers, or candles, some little shrine, so that again, you can be extremely non-coercive with the mind. I think this is important, right? You can just bring your body to that space, and then the mind naturally associates to increased sense of care, of decompression, of holding. Yeah. So So that's really the first step with some home practice. Now, of course, once we trust that we have a place where we can practice, then it becomes easier to do this elsewhere, right? The mind starts to internalize that experience and it internalizes that imagery. Of course, we do this with people too, right? Which is why our spiritual teachers are so important. We nurture that connection so that we're carrying that feeling of being cared for, of compassion, wherever we go. But we are sensitive creatures, right? So we need experiences to reinforce that capacity to tap into a sense of bare attention. Yeah, so if it's possible to designate a space in your home, I encourage you wholeheartedly to do so. And again, I'm aware often we're sharing spaces, so it's not always possible to set up a particularly ornate shrine, and that's okay. It can be very simple, very spare, but so helpful. Right. If you have a place where you know in the morning you can just bring your chair or you can sit or you can even lie down in front of it, regardless of the state of your mind, I think you will find that your mind more easily connects with those deeper layers of spaciousness. Now, because the mind is such an active place typically, this is why we also have recitations, so that we can find a way into what we're trying to cultivate. And in the Tibetan tradition, we typically begin our practice with a refuge prayer or recitation and a bodhicitta prayer or recitation. And I read that last week, but I'll offer it to you here now. In the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, I take refuge until enlightenment is reached. Through the merits of giving and other virtuous deeds, may I attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all beings. And we would recite that three times. Again, as a way of being very gentle with the mind, right? We sometimes feel in practice that we need to yank the mind out of where it's previously been. And I would suggest this can happen in interpersonal experience too, where there's a sense of having to, at times in a jarring way, transition into some new state of being or some new state of mind. But if we have recitations, we can be extremely patient with ourselves. Right? So if the mind is experiencing a strong feeling, or it's grappling with something complex, if it feels like it shouldn't let go of what it's grappling with, having those recitations is a way to both be extremely patient and gentle with oneself, and then just allow the awareness to more naturally develop, naturally unfold. As we hear those words in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, I take refuge until enlightenment is reached. It can stir some more tender feeling in the heart, that I don't just have to take refuge in CNN and MSNBC and the New York Times. I can take refuge in other reliable resources, right, that can offer support as I'm navigating this sci-fi experience. I can take refuge in teachers who offer me some clarity and love. An inspiration. That's the Buddha, right? Can take refuge in the spiritual teachings. And probably you've all been finding your way back into your beloved spiritual texts, because they offer not only emotional sustenance, but they offer the awareness of reality that we're so needing. And then I can take refuge in spiritual community, find my spiritual friends to support me as I'm finding my way through. Yeah. And then the second part of that recitation, the bodhicitta prayer, is a way to reinforce every time we practice. I find it moving each time I think about this. Oof, I'm feeling it. I'm feeling the the truth of how beautiful it is that when we practice for every single human being. Yeah. And we dedicate our practice to every single human being. And so often we're aware of our own experience. You can see I've had experiences recently that are very, very moving to me. They generate a lot of love and some sadness, some sorrow. But the bodhicitta prayer is a reminder, it's a reinforcement that when we're working with our own mind and heart, we really are offering something precious to people who are suffering. Right? And you're all such extraordinarily sensitive, compassionate people, so that question about what to offer is very present in your mind. Right? What can I do? How can I alleviate the suffering that's so pervasive? And I want to suggest that while, of course, we can think carefully about what we can offer concretely, right? Our resources of time, our financial resources, etc., resources of food, helping neighbors, whatever we can do concretely, our spiritual practice is such a profound offering. It really is. It's not a feel-good teaching. It's a teaching that is born out of reality. Because again, the most precious thing that we have is our state of mind, right? The nature of our psyche. And whether or not the mind and the heart is open enough to be impacted by what others are experiencing. Right? If we're in a more protected state, if we're using our spiritual practice for our own well-being alone, it can make it more challenging to feel into the depths of how profoundly connected we are. And so when you're cultivating your home practice, even if you have a lot of strong feeling, like I clearly do, you can go to your place that you associate with practice and then begin your recitations, your refuge and your bodhicitta recitations. And traditionally, we would recite these three times. And then just allow your mind to notice what it experiences as you touch into that sense of grounding your practice in the well-being of others. Yeah. Now, after doing some recitation, some prayer, and in the Tibetan tradition, we also do the prayer of the four immeasurables, right, which are thought to be four qualities that we just can't get enough of. And I know you've explored these before, qualities of loving kindness and compassion and steadfast joy and equanimity. After, again, we allow for those recitations, often what happens is the body begins to settle of its own accord. And really that's the nervous system responding to those conditions that support the decompression, that support increased feelings of safety and ease. It's one of the reasons why I love these recitations. The body feels that the mind is beginning to become more focused, right? And when the mind is more focused, the nervous system starts to feel a little more calibrated, starts to feel a sense of increased containment. And so the beauty of having this designated place where your mind automatically associates to practice, and then doing some recitations, is that the body will then help the mind start to feel an increased sense of well-being. Right? Because all of that nervous energy that for many of us is running high will start of its own accord to begin to decrease. Yeah. And as the mind is settling and the body is settling, you can then turn to the breath. And the breath, as you know, is an object of focus that as long as we're alive is with us, right? We get to take it with us wherever we go. And in our home practice, again, if you're feeling a lot, if your mind has been vigilantly engaged, there's nothing more helpful than appealing to the breath to experience that sense that the mind is actually extremely responsive to some indicators that it's okay to release some of that vigilance. And that's why I tend to, when I'm guiding meditation, suggest a few rounds of slower inhalation, followed by some gentle breath holding, followed by a slower, deeper exhalation. That process will very naturally help the body, again, feel a sense of being more contained, more supported, a little safer, right? The parasympathetic and the sympathetic parts of the autonomic nervous system will more naturally feel a sense of balance and ease. Yeah. So I highly recommend every day, and you can do this, of course, a few times a day, to work with the breath. Some of you are working very hard now, and you're offering a great deal of care, and you might be holding a lot, right? Holding a lot of your own experience, but holding a lot of many other people's experience. And so it's extremely helpful to work with the breath as a way, not just to relax, although of course that's lovely, but to more deeply feel that inner sense of safety, which I would want to suggest we need now more than ever. We really need to be able to tap into some reliable, deeply felt, visceral sense of safety, regardless of our circumstance. Yeah. So in your home practice, after you've done some recitations, you're sitting at your shrine, you can then do some breath work. And just a few rounds, you'll begin to notice often that you start to plummet in a gentle way into those deeper layers of the mind, the heart, that place of clear seeing, that spaciousness. And as you're doing so, if you wish, and this can be a way to expand your practice, you can then bring that clarity to a teaching. You can begin to bring that spaciousness that's now mixed with the discursive mind, which is so interesting, right? Because we're learners, we're thinkers, we have this extraordinary capacity to reflect on our experience. But if we can bring that reflective function into a more spacious state, the learning becomes quite extraordinary. It's not just conceptual. It becomes more visceral. And so you can bring the mind to a teaching. It could be the teaching of interbeing. It could be the teaching of impermanence. It could be the teaching of patience, the teaching of generosity. Whatever it is, you can let a teaching become your object of focus. And it's such a beautiful way to practice. Right? Often we can associate practice with just keeping the mind still. But actually, we still the mind so that we can open to reality. And by reality, I mean all of these sacred teachings that orient us toward what is true, right? What we can understand, and what helps us to navigate life with a sense of well-being. And so you can take it, even if it's a few minutes, to investigate, to explore a teaching. And I would encourage you to choose teachings that really feel relevant to what you're going through. And you can think through the many teachings you've explored at CMC. Find the ones that speak to you now. Right? And after you've done your recitations and some breath work, just allow the mind to rest on this teaching, explore it a little bit in a gentle way. You could be asking yourself some opening questions. Right? What is the nature of patience? How might it be expressed at this time? Yeah. And then lastly, with practice, however you find yourself doing it, in the Tibetan tradition, we dedicate our practice. And it's interesting because it takes us back to how we open the practice with bodhicitta prayers. Again, as a way of reinforcing that we have these extraordinary resources of healing. Right? They're truly extraordinary. But what makes them extraordinary is they underscore the truth of how profoundly in connection we are. How our minds create the minds of others. Right, how our bodies come out of the body of another. How the bodies that we sustain are sustained by the food grown by another, brought to us by another. Right, the level of connectivity is all pervasive. Right? It pervades psychic reality, it pervades physical reality, it pervades spiritual reality. And so when we dedicate our practice, right, may this time of practice usher in my own deepest well-being, grounded in the well-being of all precious human lives, then we're reinforcing that link right, between our own healing, our own capacity to recover from whatever it is we might be going through, and I'm aware we're going through quite a lot, to the healing and the recovery of all beings, right? And this, of course, is a beautiful way to reinforce the importance of equanimity. It's easier sometimes to imagine that we're going to dedicate our well-being to the people we love. It's more of a stretch to imagine doing that for the people we have no personal affiliation with. But of course, those are the people who compose this world. Right? It's such a tiny number of people we have personal affiliation with. It is the vast majority we do not know personally, but who, like us, are blown away by what we're going through, are longing to feel well and to trust that we can recover, are longing to trust that our minds and our bodies can remain relatively intact as we navigate this. Right, so when we dedicate our practice, we are nurturing our awareness that every human being we are in profound connection with, because like us, they genuinely want to be well, they want to be happy, they want to be free from all forms of suffering. And then we can also cultivate that equanimity by offering our practice also to people we have difficulty with. And this is a challenging practice, but probably for those of you who have been doing this for some time, what you find is that below the levels of personal discord, below the frustration, and maybe even below the feeling of disconnection that can come out of conflict, you very easily, very naturally tap into that awareness that you share the same longing. It is a primordial source of longing for wellness, for safety, for ease, for freedom from every form of suffering, psychological, emotional, physical, economic, whatever it might be. That is our common ground. Yeah. And so all that to say, I invite you to practice dedicating your spiritual efforts to all beings. It's a beautiful way to note, right, what your practice is for. It's also a beautiful way to just note you are now going to be transitioning back into your secular life, right? Every time you practice, we can end with dedication. And then the dedication is a way, it's a kind of roadmap back into life. Yeah. So I see that we're just beginning to wind down. I want to just thank you. Thank you all. I just feel such depth of love and appreciation for each one of you for being my spiritual friend during this time, being part of this community, and creating a sacred space where we can all come together and support one another as we ride all of these stormy waves and hopefully find our way to a place of increased calm and well-being. So thank you so much, everyone. I hope you have a safe week, a week of good relative health and mind and body. And I hope to see you very soon.